Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today, June 22nd, 2003, we are coming to you live from Campbell Hall, the University of Illinois campus in Urbana, Illinois, and a beautiful Sunday it is here in East Central Illinois. And I hope, glad those of you who are partaking in the show, I hope you're able to do so outdoors with a transistor radio so you can enjoy this lovely weather. We've got a great show for you today. Our guest is going to be Michael Albert, the co-founder of Z Magazine and ZNet. Albert's political involvement, starting in the 1960s and continuing to the present, have ranged from local, regional, and national organizing projects and campaigns. He is one of the co-founders of South End Press, Z Magazine, the Z Media Institute, and, as I said, ZNet. And he's the author of numerous books, including a couple of books with Robin Hanel, Looking Forward, Participatory Economics in the 21st Century, and the Political Economy of Participatory Economics. And then most recently, his new book that just came out a couple months ago, Pari Khan, Life After Capitalism. Michael Albert, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Thanks so much for joining us, Michael, on a Sunday afternoon.
Thank you for having me, although you've already made me a bit jealous.
Oh, really?
Here.
Is the weather still terrible in the east?
Really pretty bad.
Yeah, I've heard it's just been a nightmare spring, early summer this year.
Yeah. Cold, rainy, wet.
Well, you know, I think you should just take up, move out of Woods Hole in that terrible place in Cape Cod and move here to East Central Illinois.
Well, now I have to admit, I'm no longer jealous. It's quite pleasant here in general.
Yeah, I'm well aware of that. Well, Michael, for a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with Z Magazine and ZNet and your work, but let's just start with some basics. You were one of the co-founders of a couple of sort of dominant institutions in the alternative or independent media scene in the United States, South End Press and Z Magazine. And since then, ZNet. Why don't you just briefly give a little background on those institutions, your role with them, and what they do?
Well, okay. South End Press started, gosh, I'm so terrible with dates, over 20 years ago, I guess 25 years ago, actually.
Back in the 70s?
Yeah, late 70s. And the idea was to publish books, to try and do an editorial focus that would address the broad range of concerns of a leftist concern to make life better. So economics, international relations, but also gender, race, culture, the gamut of concerns that a caring human being ought to have in a society like ours or in any society. And the parallel concern was to build it in a way that would exemplify our values. That's a long story, but the essence of it was that we wanted to even while functioning within a marketplace and thus having to compete and deal with banks and all the rest, we still wanted, to the extent possible, to incorporate values like solidarity and equity, people controlling their own lives in the institution we built. It was a tough haul, but I think we did a reasonably good job. And then roughly 10 years later, Lydia Sargent and I, she had been involved also in doing South End Press, decided we'd try and do a magazine, and that was Z Magazine. And there the idea was somewhat similar, except now in a magazine format. And some years later, we realized the Internet was going to be a big factor, and so began work on a series of projects that ultimately became ZNet. And we do some other things, too, Z Video and a school that we do in the summer called ZMI. So we've got a bunch of operations that are interconnected, and that try to add to the sum total of information and vision and analysis that people have in order to try and deal with the beast.
Are you still involved with South End Press at all?
Not really. That is to say, South End exists, Z exists. They're separate institutions. When we left, we really did leave, mm-hmm. and other people remained and did the job.
Because South End is still quite active and publishing publishing lots of books every year, although, interestingly, not your books.
No. They actually turned this book down.
Oh, really? Pari Khan?
Yeah.
Now, is that the correct pronunciation of the title, Pari Khan?
Well, participatory economics, so Pari Khan, I guess, yeah.
Okay.
They turned the book down, or they turned versions of it, or proposals for versions of it down. I think it's probably because they partly had Looking Forward already. They wanted me to do something else, which was Trajectory of Change. Mm-hmm. And so this new book was done with Verso, press located in London and also New York, and another leftist press.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about Z Magazine? You started it. I mean, it really came on, I think, with a large splash for those in the independent and left media community back in, I think, like 87, 88, in that era.
Mm-hmm.
And you were editor with Lydia. You co-ran it with Lydia for years. Now, how is Z doing? What's its circulation? If people want to learn more about it, you know, where would they go to find out about it?
Well, let me do the last first. They could go to the website, which is partly Z and partly a broader system called ZNet, which is www.zmag.org. Z itself is online now, the home magazine, for people who decide to subscribe, but it's very inexpensive. And then after a lag, it goes online publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And then ZNet is just a huge site. Z Magazine has fluctuated in its size. It turns out that the size of print periodicals is overwhelmingly, at least as far as I can understand it, correlated to the amount of money available to spend on mailings. I think if you looked for variables, that would more closely approximate scale of size than any other, by a large margin. So Z has always been small. The print runs vary, you know, up around 16, 17,000 to 20,000, back down, back up.
Actually, that's not that small.
Well, it's a big country.
Yeah, well, that's true. I've been involved with some magazines that would really be happy to get 16,000 circulation.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure that's true, but... but it is a function of, you can see how much it's a function of available assets for the mailings when you look at the website. Because in the website, you don't have the same barriers to entry. It doesn't cost quite as much. I mean, it's still a factor, but it's more of an even playing field. And ZNet is used by roughly 300,000 people a week.
300,000 unique visitors a week at ZNet?
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, that's when it's up. It climbs. It gets even more at times. ZNet is very large now, but it's all over the world. So it isn't just the United States.
No, you basically...
There's about 135,000 people who receive email updates.
Mm-hmm.
And it's grown, you know, it's sort of a depressing sidelight of this kind of work, that sometimes your projects grow most in times that are odious. So wars come along, and of course interest picks up. You're sort of counter-cyclical, where the cycle that you're counter to is sort of good times. So that's a depressing element. But on the other hand, the institution keeps growing and having an impact.
No, in fact, my experience and from talking to editors of publications like In These Times, The Nation, The Progressive, up and down the list of alternative, independent, and left media is that the bad times politically, as they see them, usually translate into record circulation increases for them. And I think all those publications I just named are at their all-time highs in terms of circulation right now, or close to it.
I'd be surprised if that was the case, because there is a countervailing factor now. And the countervailing factor is the Internet, which on the one hand, of course, helps outreach, particularly it helps outreach for Internet sites. But on the other hand, there's a certain number of people who feel that they can get what they need online and they don't need to spend money to subscribe. And that does cut into circulation, paid circulation.
Yeah, you know,
I think both those factors are at work.
But in the, we had Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, on the show about 2 months ago and spoke at some length about this. And he said that, interestingly enough, along these lines, that Progressive now, its circulation is up maybe 25% from what it was just 3 or 4 years ago.
Huh.
And that his website, if anything, has really helped their circulation, because they draw now hundreds of subscribers per year, if not more.
Yeah, I think he's right. That is to say, his website will help his circulation, just like ZNet helped ours. But I'm not sure that the overall effect helps print circulation. On the other hand, it does... You know, we're reaching many, many, many more people than ever in the past. So on balance, things are obviously to the good.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about ZNet, because you, if I understand it right, Michael, you sort of split off from Z Magazine a few years back to really focus on building up ZNet, which is the Internet and email-based system. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, split off, we actually do this stuff out of our house.
Same room.
So I didn't split too far.
Yeah, yeah.
From one room to another. But yes, my focus, actually, even before the web became visible, I was starting to try to do this. So we were a kind of a provider for a little while, even giving people their internet access and email and so on, although that was very torturous. And then we, you know, gravitated toward doing the web and have gone through various incarnations since. But yeah, it is mostly what I do, Zenon, overwhelmingly, actually.
This is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580 here in Urbana, Illinois. My guest today on the phone from his home in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, Michael Albert, the co-founder of Z Magazine and ZNet, and now very active in ZNet, a prominent political theorist and left-wing social activist, joining us. If you'd like to call in and speak to Michael Albert, and we can talk about virtually any subject, I think it's safe to say, dealing with politics with Michael Albert. The number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And maybe for people who are unfamiliar with CNET, Michael, you could give a sense of the sort of issues that you cover in it. What are the topics? Who are the sort of people who write for it? Give a sense of the flavor of CNET.
Well, it's got... How do I describe it? It has, I don't know, 30 or 40 watch areas. A watch area would be, say, Columbia Watch, or, you know, so it could be countries, it could be topics, repression.
Basically what reporters would call beats.
Yeah, I guess so, in a sense. They're sort of like sub-sites.
Mm-hmm.
So you click on it, and you got a whole bunch more stuff around that sub-site. So there's stuff like that. There's obviously daily updates on the top page of all sorts of information, but there are other things. So, for instance, there's a pen pal system, which I have to admit, when we started it, I was sort of skeptical. But there's thousands of people in there, and you look at their bios, and it's quite remarkable. People from all over the world, all kinds of backgrounds, all kinds of interests, and apparently using this system to communicate with one another. There's a system for people to upload articles. There's, you know, a system with song lyrics. Then there are sections, you know, on vision, particularly economic vision, but not only. Really, pretty much anything that you might be interested in, you'll find someplace in here. Science discussion and so on. It's quite large. There's tens of thousands of items. I suppose you might say it's one of the nice things about a website as compared to print media is that the space is really quite unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
So it just keeps growing.
And then you've got the daily emails you talked about that go out to an extraordinary number of people, over 100,000.
Well, no, it's two different things here.
There's
an update system which goes out to about 130,000, 135,000 people, and that happens periodically. So this morning I sent one out. Then there's a program that's for sustainers. These are for people who give donations on some regular basis to all of our operations, ZNet and Z and so on. And that's a daily commentary, which goes out each night, every night of the year. And that's a pretty remarkable array of writers who, and yourself being one.
Well, actually, I'm less of a writer than I am a reader, and that's what I was thinking of, because I've been a customer of it since the very beginning. And, yeah, I want to vouch for it. It's an extraordinary service that you provide, because you get daily commentaries and articles by a whole range of writers on a whole range of issues, but especially the pressing political stories. Now, obviously, war and peace, civil liberties, social justice dominating the attention.
Yeah, so that's a program, and that program actually is critical now to our well-being, I suppose you could say. The donations that people are providing are very instrumental for ZNet and also for Z and Z Media Institute and all the rest of the stuff we do.
Well, let's talk politics for a second before we go back into the media. I mean, what are the crucial issue of the last few months has probably been almost certainly the U.S. invasion of Iraq and occupation now and reconstruction of Iraq. What has been your take on that?
Oh, I think pretty much like most other people on the left that to broaden it out, that the Bush administration has a kind of a two-pronged agenda. On the one hand, they want to turn back the clock on international affairs, pretty much to neocolonialism. They want to create a context in which violence rules. The reason for that is because we have a monopoly on violence, or a virtual monopoly on it. So if you make the currency of international affairs violence, then the United States simply dictates terms around the world, and that's their goal. But domestically, I think, and this is less evident and less discussed, I think there's also a powerful and disturbing agenda. I think domestically they also want to turn back the clock, and now the idea is to sort of roll back the gains that have been made by virtually any constituency that you can think of that other than those at the very top of society, so women, blacks, Latinos, workers, roll back the kinds of improvements in life that have been won, but which put limits on those at the top, which put limitations on how much power they have and how much of the social product they can take in the form of profits. How do you do that? You can't get up at a campaign and say, all right, I want to roll back the clock. I want to get rid of welfare and Medicaid. I want to get rid of public spending on education and health care. I just want to create a situation in which the rich and powerful get whatever they want. You can't run on a platform like that. You can't say you want to do that. Just like internationally, you can't get up and say, I want empire. I want to run the world. I want to use the military might that we have to dictate terms far and wide. You can't do that either. So in both cases, you need to sort of engineer a rationalization, a justification for what you're doing. And internationally, the mechanism is fear, fear of terrorism, which is used to sort of bludgeon obedience. And domestically, I think what they have in mind, I don't know whether this can be pulled off, it's certainly up to us whether or not it succeeds, but I think what they have in mind is pretty similar. Fear of disaster. That is to say, they're on a path to more or less wreck or abuse the economy, so much so that it creates fear of economic dislocation and disaster and pain, at which point they say the only way out of this gargantuan mess, a mess that they will have created, is to cut all these government programs. So they cut the programs as a solution, ostensibly, but that's what they're doing. So it's more or less destroy the economy and then rebuild it without all the things that working people and others have won over the decades. And these are pretty disturbing scenarios, to say the least. But on the other side of the coin, dissent is greater than I remember in the last four decades.
Really? Even going back to the 60s, Michael?
Yeah, I think certainly what happened in February 15th was unprecedented. So the scale of international opposition, I don't want to argue, and I wouldn't say that organized dissent in the United States right now is what it was, say, in 1968. But it also has features that, while the scale might not be as great, it has features that transcend anything that we had in 1968. So nowadays, the slogan from the World Social Forum, for example, "Another World is Possible," is a powerful touchstone among dissidents and is beginning to cause people to realize that they have to answer the question, what do you want? And similarly, the idea of solidarity, of people having a degree of mutual support, is much stronger now than it has been in the past, I think. So I think there's a kind of a sophistication and a commitment that maybe didn't exist or existed narrowly then, and there's much more potential now. So I actually am quite optimistic, more optimistic than I've been in a very long time, about both short-term and in particular longer-term prospects.
Yeah, there seems to be, though, to temper your optimism, which I might add I share, mm-hmm. but there people say, isn't there a disconnect then between the reality of our electoral political system in this country and our political culture and our media culture, which seems to reflect none of the grounds of optimism you have?
Sure. I mean, it's the best of times and the worst of times. That is, at the institutional level of who's exercising power and the agenda they have, it's the worst of times. That two-pronged sort of agenda on the part of Bush and co. is the worst I've seen in you know, since I've been able to discern. I don't think anybody has had a vision for the United States and the world that's more horrifying than the one that these guys are unraveling.
Do you think?
And,
do you know,
and they're making progress at it.
Yeah,
so that part is horrific.
Yeah. What comparing Bush, and this is a sidelight I just want to get to, but I mean, people talk about him, and I know you have, just being unbelievably bad vision and negative. And much worse than anything before. How does he compare to his father or to the administration of Ronald Reagan?
Well, it's similar. I mean, the difference is that he has 9/11. That is to say, his father and Bush Sr. and others as well, you know, arguably John Kennedy, people have had high hopes for aggrandizing the power and the wealth of elites and have been quite willing to engage in you know, horrible acts to bring it to pass. So there's nothing new in that. What's new here, I think, is that that this thing, 9/11, happened, and that they immediately took tremendous advantage of it, trying to parlay understandable fear, understandable anger, understandable just concern and confusion into support for their agenda. And they did a good job of it in the short run. And that's still being determined, what the outcome will be. So it isn't so much that they are more evil or something like that. It's that a context arose in which they had the possibility of pursuing an agenda, and they did so.
You're listening to Michael Albert today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesson, here in WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. If you'd like to call in and ask Michael Albert a question, our number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. And let me just point out now, while I have this moment, that our upcoming guest on Media Matters in the next few weeks, next week we are going to have legendary book publisher Andre Schifrin, head of the New Press, talking about the state of book publishing in the world and in the United States today, changes in the industry in the past 10 years, and what that means for authors, for readers, and for our political culture. 2 weeks from today, an author who actually going to relate to the subject we're about to turn to in this show, Jim Weinstein, founder of In These Times, who has a new book out, The Long Detour, on what has happened to the socialist movement in the United States and the cause of socialism in the United States in the past 50 years. 3 weeks from today, Saul Landau, radio commentator, author, and expert on Latin American politics. And then finally, 4 weeks from today, another alternative or independent press editor, Katrina Vandenhoevel from The Nation magazine. So that's our lineup for the next 4 weeks here on Media Matters. Again, the lines are open if you would like to talk to Michael Albert. And Michael, I think this is a good time, if we can, to turn to your new book, which is Par Econ, or Participatory Economics. And this book just came out with Verso a couple months ago, and I had the privilege of reading it in galley. So I'm familiar with it. Why don't you give a brief summary of why you wrote the book and what you're arguing in the book?
Well, the reason we wrote the book, or more largely the reason I concerned myself with economic vision, is because it seems to me that the question, what do you want, is sometimes put to us as a kind of a bait, but is usually very sincere. That is to say, people want to know what is it that we think can be done to the world that would make it a better place and that would make it worthwhile to engage themselves actively in dissent. People feel, and I don't think this is a crazy feeling, people feel that if dissenting is rolling rocks up hills only to have them sort of roll back down and crush you, in other words, if Margaret Thatcher is right that there is no alternative, then they feel that with what little time they have from their long job or two jobs and the responsibilities they have for their families and so on, they don't want to devote much or perhaps any of it to social dissent. On the other hand, if we could make a compelling case that there's a worthy and a viable alternative to capitalism, then I think we would do much better in our efforts to organize people. So I do it because I think it's needed in order to reach people much more widely than we're reaching now. What is it? Well, it's a vision for an economic alternative to capitalism. That means it's a description of a set of institutions for accomplishing production, consumption, allocation, economic functions, in a manner differently than capitalism does, in a manner that instead of producing vast inequalities of wealth and income and power, instead of, you know, subordinating most people to the will of a few, instead of having the negative attributes of the economy around us, not only meets needs and develops potentials, but furthers values that we hold dear, and the values that it centers on are solidarity, diversity, equity, and self-management. And the institutions, without going into any kind of detail, unless you want to pursue it, are a new way of doing allocation. It's called participatory planning. Well, you know, a new way of organizing workplaces with workers' councils and consumers' councils and what's called balanced job complexes, and new norms for what determines how much income we all get, remuneration for effort and sacrifice.
Well, let me just, before we go into too much detail, I mean, the way you described it at the outset sounds a lot like the promise that has been given historically for socialism.
Sure.
It's the logical post-capitalist society that's been, for two centuries, has been the vision of the left until quite recently. Socialism met communism of the most barbaric nature in the form of Stalin, but I think in virtually every version, an authoritarian society, hardly liberatory. Is that what you're proposing? Something?
No,
like?
Which is why the name of the system is participatory economics and not, say, participatory socialism. If by socialism you or anybody means an economy that meets needs, that develops potentials, that delivers to people control over their own lives, that has workers controlling the workplace, that's classless, and so on, then a person who feels that that's what socialism means, the word, might very well decide, well, participatory economics is, in fact, the kind of socialism that I've been an advocate of. But the problem with that way of sort of using words is that for most people on the planet, socialism means one or another of the systems that have actually existed in the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia and China and so on. Or it means, for some who are more academic, a system that's been described in texts and in virtually manuals on what it means to, you know, construct an economy. And all of those models have in common features which participatory economics just completely rejects.
Like what?
Well, all of them have either central planning or markets for allocation, and participatory planning rejects both. They all have corporate workplace divisions of labor. That's actually just the same kind of division of labor that you can see in Ford Motor Company. And participatory economics rejects that as well. They all remunerate, that is, the amount of income that each actor gets is a function either of their bargaining power in what's called market socialism, or of their class position in what's called centrally planned socialism, or both of which are rejected in participatory economics. So as far as institutions, as far as rhetoric, adjectives, so to speak, are concerned, a person might say, well, participatory economics is just socialism. But as far as the actual institutions are concerned, the institutions are very different than anything that has taken that name, and so we give it a new name.
But some people would say, they say, well, look, the Russian Revolution coming out of the Soviet councils in 1917, mm-hmm. the Paris Commune, example after example, started with actually very egalitarian notions of sort of workers' control, not having a central state or a police state, but quickly degenerated or gravitated toward exactly what you're criticizing. Isn't that just sort of inherent in these sort of systems that they seem to always degenerate?
I don't think so. I think that actually degeneration is not the right word for what happened. Rather, the right word for what happened might be that the base of people, the large numbers of people who were excited about change and struggling for it in workplaces and throughout those countries, wanted something like what we're both describing as positive. But the movements that were developed, the actual leadership of those movements and the movements themselves were structured in a way that led to something entirely different. And rather than the idea that things degenerated, I actually think that, you know, the Russian Revolution achieved what it sought out to achieve. It achieved what the institutional structure of the movement and what the commitments of the movement institutionally sought. Now, much of the membership thought that it would have much nicer effects on people's lives. But that's true of, you know, electing the next president, too. A lot of people do it and think that it's going to have nice effects on people's lives. But if you look at the real substance, you can predict otherwise. Same thing with these movements. If you have movements whose organizational structure will melt into an authoritarian form, if you have movements that elevate the people who have a relative monopoly on knowledge and information and skills to dominant positions, you can pretty much predict, I think you can with great confidence predict, the kind of social structures that will emerge from them. So participatory economics isn't just a vision for a new kind of economy. It's also has implications for what we do in the present, for how we organize ourselves, for what kinds of choices we make in developing a movement to win a new society.
Yeah, how so?
Well, most of the organizations that have sought what's been called socialism or centrally planned, I'd call it coordinatorism or market coordinatorism, i.e. economies in which about 20% of the population monopolize control over economic life, most of those movements have been Leninists. They have employed movements that have a kind of an organizational engine, a vehicle, whose structure is very much like the society that they build. It's very top-down. It's very regimented. It accrues authority into a relatively few hands. This is very different than kinds of things that you see happening around the world right now in Argentina, in the movements that existed around the war, in the corporate globalization movement. In all these popular movements nowadays, you see a tremendous emphasis on participation, on true democracy, what we might call self-management, people having a say in what affects them. If you can imagine a movement that builds in that kind of structure, that builds in that kind of participation, then you can imagine a process that might lead to a better economy, an economy like participatory economics, rather than like what's gone under the name socialism, but really was, I would argue, something that we might better call, after its ruling class, coordinatorism.
Okay, we're talking to Michael Albert today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about his new book, Participatory Economics, or Par Econ, just published by Verso, in which he offers an alternative vision for how we can organize material life in our society that's non-capitalistic and non-socialistic in the traditional sense of the term socialism, and more egalitarian and democratic and inviting social justice. If you'd like to call in and talk with Michael Albert, our phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. And if you would like to get a weekly update on who our guests are going to be, what they've written, forthcoming guests, and a way to give us some feedback, you can write our producer, Kumi Silva, and send her an email. And her email address is kumis@uiuc.edu, and she will get you on our weekly mailer. We've got several hundred people doing this now, and we haven't had many people try to get off the list, so it seems to be pretty popular with those who are doing it. Well, Michael, I know you have heard all the criticism. This is utopian. This is crazy. People in this country, I mean, even the left fringe of respectable politics, not respectable, any sort of organized electoral politics, say Ralph Nader, wasn't suggesting anything along these lines. I mean, to even posit a political change to get us to a social democratic, a capitalist society with a large welfare state and more commitment to more egalitarian economics, and not even a socialist society, but you still have profit-making running society, that's almost beyond the pale, even for the left wing in this country. How do you, you know, this...
Well, it could be that part of the reason why many plausible changes that would make life better, but that fall far short of, you know, what I'm talking about, seem so impossible is because they can't galvanize sufficient support. And then you have to ask, well, why can't they galvanize sufficient support? Why don't people do what seems like it ought to be pretty obvious, lend their time and energy to campaigns that would, as you say, win social democratic reforms that would improve health care or improve the distribution of wealth or improve housing or health or education and so on. And I think a big part of the reason, not the only reason by a long shot, but a big part of the reason might be that people are skeptical of any such changes persisting. We've spent the last 30 or 40 years trying to communicate to people that capitalism, and for that matter, patriarchy and racism and authoritarian structures, that these institutional structures have powerful effects, that they sort of generate a kind of field of force that corrupts and molds life options for people, and that delimits what's possible. And I think we've done a very good job of that. Such a good job of that, in fact, that nowadays most people are skeptical about anything better lasting. They feel that, yes, maybe you could, with a tremendous amount of effort, improve wages, improve the tax code, get a little bit of investment going in the direction of better housing and so on, but shortly thereafter it would just roll back. And there's no understanding or hope that the efforts to win changes, instead of rolling back in time, would continue in a trajectory that kept making things more and more better, so to speak. If you feel that way, if you feel that your efforts will be undone, then you have a relatively low incentive, I guess you might say, to give of your very sparse time to social struggle. If, on the other hand, you have the feeling that, well, we can win something now, and not only can we win it, but we can win new conditions under which we'll be able to win still more, and that this sort of trajectory of winning gain after gain will continue, and it will actually lead someplace, unlike what Margaret Thatcher suggested, it will actually lead to new institutions in which, instead of having to continually fight to win anything good, the institutions themselves will be good, and the conditions under which we live will be different. With that kind of hope, and I suspect that kind of hope is what moves people like yourself and me and many others, with that kind of hope, the incentive to participate, the reason to feel that one's contribution will be worth one's time, goes way up, I think. So I actually think that having an understanding of a vision of an alternative to capitalism and faith in its potentials and in its worthiness, and the same for other aspects of life, is critical not just to the long-term prospects of the left, but to the immediate-term prospects in terms of trying to win the types of reforms that you mentioned. It's a difference between those reforms being reformist, in other words, being Band-Aids, which you win with the expectation that somebody will eventually pull them off and the pain will recur, and those reforms being non-reformist, that is, gains that you win and which you solidify and which you use as a basis for winning still more gains, where you can understand what that pattern forward is. And I think that change in mentality would do a lot for short-term struggle and long-term struggle.
We're talking to Michael Albert today in Media Matters. He's our guest. He's talking about his new book, Par Econ, about participatory economics and the need for an alternative vision and a program to reconstruct our political economies in the United States and worldwide. We have a couple of callers. I want to get to the phone lines. If you'd like to join us, the number is 333-9455. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Line 1, Charleston, you're on the air with Michael Albert.
Hi. I'd just like to thank you for your really insightful comments. It's really interesting listening to you. And also like to comment that I think a lot of the reason the right has been successful is that they've done exactly what you said. It may be a sham, but they've come up with a vision that they sold to people that's long-term. My question actually has to do with social democracy. I was wondering what your assessment is of societies such as Scandinavia in which social democracy has become more solidly established.
Well, actually, I think it's not so solidly established anymore. That is to say...
Michael, can I interrupt for one second? Yeah. Maybe for the sake of listeners who might not be familiar with Sweden and social democracy, because it's not a common concept. Just give a little one-sentence summary or two-sentence summary.
Really, social democracy is capitalism, like we have capitalism, except with working people having much more bargaining power. That's the way I understand it anyway. And that additional bargaining power means that working people get a bigger piece of the social product. Their relative incomes are higher. They're in a position to make demands about government spending. So the balance of where government spending goes is more attuned to the well-being of working people and poor people than it is in a situation where they have less power. It might be cemented in the form of a government and of a political party which is aligned with what's called social democracy, but the underlying factor, the underlying key factor, is that balance of power. And then we shouldn't be too surprised that if the balance of power shifts, the level of what we might call social democracy begins to change too. So in Scandinavia, as ruling elites, corporate classes, owners, and the like, begin to accrue more power, the balance shifts and the social democratic features begin to erode. And that's happened over the last decade or so, maybe a little bit more. So do I prefer a capitalist economy in which working people have more power to one in which they have less? Yes, very much so. And do I think that the gains that they win with that greater power are worthy gains and worthwhile and make people's lives better? Yes, I do. But I also think that the ultimate status or condition of working people as people who have to sell their ability to labor and work in corporations where they have no say and so on isn't really touched by it, and that the gains are quite unstable. And so in order to really stabilize them, you need to change the institutions. So that's why I favor a completely different system rather than just changing the balance of power within the system.
And then going to the caller's question, do you think you were about to say, I think at the beginning before I set you off on a different path, that that these aren't necessarily such stable societies, that the gains haven't necessarily been locked in?
No, a social democratic society is very much not a sort of a locked-in society with a new level of concern for human fulfillment. It's rather a capitalist society in which, because people who are poorer have more power, there is more concern given to their well-being. But if that balance of power shifts, then the degree of attentiveness to their well-being shifts also.
Caller, did you want to do any follow-up?
I think that was a really good answer. I guess the only follow-up I might give is, don't all societies to some extent depend on a certain psychological element and a tradition of how they operate? Or is it really possible to lock in some kind of change?
Well, look at what's locked into our society. So, for instance, in a market system, it is locked in, literally locked in, that buyers and sellers have to pursue their own advantage, virtually oblivious to the impact on others. If they don't, they go out of business. That's structurally locked into the institutions. There's other features as well. The mispricing by virtue of, I don't want to go into details, but the point is that an institution can have attributes, it can have implications that are literally a part of the institution. So dictatorship, as a simple example, has certain implications that are just intrinsic to being dictatorship. And that holds for private ownership of the means of production, it holds for markets, and it holds for what we call the corporate division of labor, in which about 20% monopolize all the decision-making positions and the empowering work. So if you were to change all those features, if you were to come up with institutions for an economy which locked in, that is, caused it to be the case that for people to do well, they had to be concerned about one another, or locked in that the amount that you got of the social product was dependent upon the effort that you expended and the sacrifice in terms of onerousness, if there is any, in the work that you do, but couldn't be increased by virtue of owning property or by virtue of increasing bargaining power. In other words, if you can lock in positive qualities by structurally building them into the institutions, that's very positive. Doesn't mean it's utopia. Doesn't mean nothing can go wrong. But it's quite the opposite of locking in negative attributes.
Michael, before we get to the next call, let me just add, if I can, I mean, when people hear about this, one of the responses I've often seen is that you say, well, aren't you battling human nature? I mean, human beings have been around for 150,000 years. We've had since 10 or 12,000 years since the rise of surplus in agriculture and civilization. And, you know, there's never been a society like that you're proposing, but there have been myriad societies where people are killing each other and ripping each other off. I mean, aren't people, isn't capitalism just accurately reflect how people naturally gravitate toward?
Well, it's one way of reading it, but here's another way of reading it, that capitalism produces the attributes that most people are causing natural. Now, how do we prove it one way or the other? That would be hard, but here's a little story. You look out the window and you see a this is a Chomsky story, actually. You look out the window and you see a child. It's a very hot day, and the kid's eating an ice cream cone. It's very hot, large man comes walking down the street, sees the ice cream cone, sees the kid, swats the kid into the gutter and takes the ice cream cone. And you're up in a balcony window. Do you think to yourself, there goes a typical specimen of humanity, out for himself and only himself, able to and willing to take advantage of all circumstances? No. You sort of think, there goes somebody who's truly pathological. That person is out of touch with what it means to be a human being. For whatever reason, they aren't a typical instance of humanity. So I actually don't think that most people really believe what they say. I think it's a rationalization. But suppose for a minute that we say something much more modest, that we say human beings are a species which has the capacity for empathy, for solidarity, for mutuality, but it also has the capacity for greed and for self-seeking. Now, this much is true. Right? It's not a matter of debate. We know humans who show both attributes. Therefore, we know that humans in different settings are capable of both those types of behavior. So the question becomes, should we have an economy which rewards greed, self-seeking, ignoring other people's well-being, which not only rewards it, but makes it almost inevitable, which makes it The baseball manager, Leo DeRocher, used to say nice guys finish last as his description, his one-liner on what our society was like. He didn't realize that that's really a devastating critique of the society, but true. So should we have institutions in which that's true, nice guys finish last, or should we have institutions in which nice guys prosper, good people do well, in which to care about other people is actually built into the system the way that you advance yourself as well? We haven't talked about the institutions of participatory economics, and nobody should take it on my word, you know, or over the radio that they accomplish that. But the claim is that they do. The claim is that participatory economics accomplishes production and consumption and allocation and does it in a way which causes people to be solidaritous with one another rather than ride roughshod over one another. If that's true, it seems to me that, you know, that we ought to be advocates of it.
Michael Albert, let's go back to the phone line. We have time for one more caller. We have someone who's been very patiently waiting. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Michael Albert.
Hello, Michael.
Hi.
I know I only have a minute, and so I'll make it brief. In 1919, the United States invaded the Soviet Union. You have to be a PhD candidate to know the facts.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in the public schools. With the precise purpose of overthrowing the workers and peasants' Soviets. The Soviets were the flower of Russian democracy. Stalin gave socialism the worst name possible. But you have to look at how corporate America treats any opponents to its own exploitation and oppression. They will do everything to isolate and surround them. China really never did have any Siberia, so to speak, even though I suppose Mao is not the saint of the world. But the question I want to ask you, and you've only got 30 seconds, and it's a big question, what do you think the chances are for a third party in this country? Because in 1910, when Victor Berger was elected the Socialist Party congressman from the 5th Congressional District of Milwaukee, he was refused to be seated. I'll let you go. Ciao.
Sure. I'm actually not sure that the way to start thinking about maybe you're right, but the way to start thinking about our electoral impact is, can there be or can't there be a third party? The real issue is, can there be or can't there be 30, 40, or 50 million people who are willing to manifest their desires in an electoral process and whose desires are markedly different from those that characterize Democrats and the Republicans? If you answer that question yes, the rest is sort of trivial. That is to say, the real question here is people having the hope and the confidence and the desire to develop an agenda and to act on it. Could the development of a fledgling third party help to spur that? Yes. Or might the third party be an outgrowth of that having been accomplished by other means? Yes. Do we know the answer? I don't think so. You know, I'm inclined to think that it's popular grassroots activism, the development and the spreading of vision and of an understanding of the processes of change that give people confidence, that will be the crucial or a crucial ingredient, and that then whether the new party pops up in a small form and grows, or sort of becomes an expression of something that's already huge in the form of vast movements across the country, you know, I don't know. I guess we'll see as time goes along.
Michael, what do you make of people, just shifted just slightly on this discussion, who say the current administration is so dangerous, both internationally and domestically, that whatever the situation, we just have to get, you know, we have to vote for any alternative that has a chance to win in 2004. It's just, this is sort of a mission critical for the survival of our species.
Well, I'm not at all sure, once again, that who is in the White House is the critical ingredient as compared to whether or not there are social pressures and movements that constrain who is in the White House. So what would have been Gore's response to 9/11? It would have been different than Bush, but it would have been despicable as well. That said, I think it would be a fine thing if Bush and Rumsfeld and all of them were swept out of Washington. As to how one best goes about that, I think there's going to be a big debate on that in coming months. You know, one version is you vote for the person who can beat Bush in a state that's close and in a state where the Democrat is going to win the state in any event. You vote for who you actually support.
You know what, Michael? I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut you off at that point. I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they're trying to push me out of the studio. I want to thank Michael Albert, the head of ZNet, or co-founder of ZNet, and co-founder of Z Magazine, for joining us today, talking about his new book, ParEcon. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
Please join us a week from today with Andre Schifrin. I'd like to thank Kumi Silva, our producer, Brett, engineer, and see you all next week.